Chapter 3. The Campaign Year. On June 16, 2015, Donald and Melania descended the golden escalator into the lobby of Trump Tower, where he announced his candidacy for president. It had all the hallmarks of a classic Trump spectacle. It was a flashy, splashy show. David and I watched it on TV, completely surprised. We had no idea about his intention to run. David's impression was that Donald was doing it as a business ploy, a way to prove how well he could get publicity while in the midst of his contract negotiations with NBC. Many pundits agreed that the whole campaign, from the very first time he uttered the phrase, build a wall, was an investment in his future earnings as a TV star, real estate mogul, or whatever other plot he had on his mind. I had to agree. Melania on the escalator, literally and figuratively, was just along for the ride. She'd been asked what kind of first lady she'd be back in 1998 when she was just the girlfriend, and replied that she'd be traditional, like Jacqueline Kennedy, an attractive, supportive wife. I wondered if my friendship with Melania would change now that her husband had finally, after years of talking about it in the press, decided to run. This could be interesting, I thought. Parallel reality. I kept track of the campaign when I could. Melania's texts kept coming, nearly every day, about the kids and her summer travels. On July 21st, 2015, a month after Donald's announcement, she wrote, DT crazy busy. Me and Barron have relaxing summer. 3 weeks later, on August 11th, from the Trump Resort in Bedminster, New Jersey, Donald is in Michigan. It's so gorgeous out. Just got back from swimming. Wish summer would last forever. It was almost like her husband wasn't running for president, or saying, they're bringing in drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, about Mexicans, or commenting that Fox News host Megyn Kelly had blood coming out of her wherever. Into the fall and winter, we resumed our monthly lunches and talked about our kids' schools and Halloween costumes and our families in general. She barely spoke about the campaign at all. When she went to New Hampshire for the Republican primary in February 2016, she didn't text about the excitement of the campaign or Donald's groundswell of support. She wrote about the weather, saying that it was cold and snowy. Breaking news. When I asked her about the hotel, she said that she brought her own linens, pillows, and terrier robe. She always did. In late February into early March, she texted me the chronicle of her kidney stone's long journey to freedom, while not once mentioning the heated debate that week between Donald and Florida Senator Marco Rubio about whether Donald's hands and other parts were unusually small. It really felt like they were living in parallel realities. Melania's emails and texts to me increased in quantity that year. More lunch date requests, more favors. Reporters needed sources for their articles about her. No one in her family spoke fluent English, so they were out. As for friends, she handpicked a very select group of us, each one blindly faithful to her. On November 18, 2015, she asked me to talk to writer Alex Kaczynski for Harper's Bazaar, and I agreed. Thank you, she replied. I know you will say great things. Watch 2020 Friday, Barbara Walters interview. Pink dress. 3 smile emojis, 3 heart emojis. She was very excited about that dress. The interview was almost beside the point. I asked her, what would you like for me to say? She texted me some guidelines about the upcoming interview. I was to say that she and Donald met 15 years ago, that she was born in Slovenia, that her sister and parents wanted to have a private life, that it was her decision not to be a part of the campaign, that she was devoted to raising Barron, that she'd had a successful business and was now enjoying life and being a mom. The enjoying life part was evident. Thank you, she texted. I am in the Caribbean. So gorgeous. Just want to stay here. Here's how Kaczynski quoted me. According to Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, a fashion industry consultant who has known Melania for nearly 20 years, Melania's even keel is part of what makes the Trump marriage work. Donald is always full speed ahead. It is constant with him, she says. But Melania went into the marriage understanding who he was, and she is accepting of him. Perfect, Melania said. I was enlisted again in May 2016 to talk to du jour reporter Mickey Rapkin. By that point, Melania had been the target of a lot of media attacks about her family, how she'd gotten her visa, why she wasn't more present on the campaign trail. She told me to tell Mickey that all the stories written about her were inaccurate. Not many people know me and have a wrong picture of me, she said. That wasn't going to work with a reporter, but okay. I would be Melania's good soldier. Sure enough, he wrote about every speck of dirt he could find, but he did give Melania plenty of room to talk about Donald in similar terms to those in which she'd spoken to me privately about Barron. Boys will be boys. From Rapkin's article, she uses that same phrase, men will be men, when asked about Donald's old appearances on Howard Stern's show, which had recently resurfaced online. Stern once asked if Donald would stay with Melania if she suffered a horrific car accident, and he replied, "How do the breasts look?" A similar vibe was conveyed when Trump came out on stage at a town hall meeting at the University of Pennsylvania in 1999 and shouted, "Where's my supermodel?" My contribution was pre-approved by Melania. Don't underestimate her just because she is quiet and reserved. There is a virtue in the fact that she appears to be quiet and isn't on the front lines constantly saying, "Hear me, see me." But she's very confident in her viewpoint. She does not agree with everything that Donald says or everything that's being done, but she believes in the greater good. They are a power couple. They are each other's teammate. He's out there. He has so much going on. It isn't about her yet. She has always said, when and if the time comes, she will step up. She is a wife and a mother until that day comes. She thanked me for speaking to the reporter and texted often about how much she valued our friendship and loved me. She always asked about my kids. I asked her for a similar favor, to talk to a Hollywood reporter journalist who was writing a piece about the Met Gala. I thought she could recount some of her experiences there or describe her favorite gown. She didn't reply to my request all day and then wrote that she hadn't seen it because she was in the spa, taking some time off so she could relax. Not in the mood to talk to HR, she said. I didn't push it. She could have done what she'd always done with press inquiries and just emailed her response. But Melania does not do what she doesn't want to do, period. Whenever I thought about the possibility of Donald's winning the election, I, now regretfully, brushed aside his divisive rhetoric and deplorable behavior, like mocking reporters or other candidates and their wives because of their physical appearance. Instead, my mind immediately went to what Melania could do from atop the highest, broadest platform on earth, and what good I could do as a private citizen if she became an actively engaged first lady who wanted to effect change and allowed me to give her advice. We could do a hell of a lot. From the very beginning, Melania told me her initiative as first lady, if that position became a reality, would be about helping children and families. We began what would be a 2-year-long mission to make a profound impact in that area. She wanted to focus it on cyberbullying. I thought she'd need to broaden the scope. Her heart was in the right place, but her messaging was off. How could Melania get on a soapbox about cyberbullying when her husband was public enemy number one on that score? It was as if she had no idea what he was tweeting. While he was crisscrossing the country, she stayed home at Trump Tower or went to their other residences in Palm Beach and Bedminster. She would text me from various locations, writing nearly identical notes like, "In Palm Beach, wish to stay here, so gorgeous," or "In the Caribbean, so gorgeous, just want to stay here." It seemed like she wanted to be anywhere but the campaign trail. She didn't register an iota of the excitement that Donald clearly felt at the rallies. Many times, while I visited her at Trump Tower or shared a car with her, Donald would call her from Ohio or Nevada or Michigan to check in. She'd answer with a breathy, "Hello?" He'd say, "Hey, baby, did you see my speech?" She would give me a knowing look and adoringly tell him, "You did a great job, honey." One evening, we were on our cell phones talking for hours while he was at some rally. She lost track of time and didn't watch a minute of it. The landline rang, and when she realized it was Donald calling, she said, "Oops, I forgot to watch his speech." We laughed that she missed him on TV entirely, but she was off to answer his call and, I'm sure, to praise his performance to the skies. Melania's convention speech. One of Melania's rare campaign appearances was in April 2016 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where she was going to give a speech. She texted me on April 4th that she was headed to Wisconsin and hated traveling alone in bad weather. She was anxious about her speech. "The more I think about it, the more knots I have in my throat," she said. You'll be fine. Take deep breaths and close your eyes. I am doing that a whole day already, she said. She managed to deliver her rally speech, which I assume she wrote herself. It closed like a love poem. He's a hard worker. He's kind. He has a great heart. He's tough. He's smart. He's a great communicator. He's a great negotiator. He's telling the truth. He's a great leader. He's fair. As you may know by now, when you attack him, he will punch back 10 times harder. No matter who you are, a man or a woman, he treats everyone equal. He's a fighter. And if you elect him to be your president, he will fight for you and for our country. He will work for you and with you, and together we will make America strong and great again. Look, she wasn't in an editorial meeting at The New Yorker. She was addressing a crowd of supporters who hadn't come to listen to her. She kept it short and simple. Donald applauded her when he came on stage and said to her, "So beautiful." She smiled placidly. From the way she inhaled sharply, she knew she had delivered. Despite what you may have read, Melania had told me many times that she wanted Donald to win. One appearance Melania could not get out of was the July 2016 Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. Not only would she have to show up and sit through so many speeches, she'd have to give one herself, as would all 4 of Donald's adult children. On June 28th, she told me, "Miss you. Working on my speech for the convention. Love you." That sent a chill down my spine. Melania had good ideas, but she was not a native English speaker or skillful writer. I called her and suggested she work with a professional and mentioned the name of someone I knew. I followed up with a text, "Do you want me to introduce you? I will never bother you, but I am here for you and would love to help you and guide you. You know you can trust me, and I know I can trust you. I love you, and all I care about is making sure you are protected and ready." She replied with the usual, "Love you, and you're the best," but she said she didn't want to talk to my guy for now. 3 weeks later, she came out of the shadows and had her moment in the spotlight. My family and I watched her speech on CNN. I wasn't such a fan of her fluffy white dress with Popeye sleeves by designer Roxana Ilinchik, but I was pleased with her delivery. I thought she came across as poised, confident, and warm. The press reported rhapsodically that Melania had insisted on writing the speech by herself, which I didn't believe. She probably did a draft, but someone else's hand had been on it. We all know what went down within hours afterward. A political journalist named Jarrett Hill noticed that passages in Melania's speech were practically word for word identical to a 2008 convention speech by Michelle Obama. The next day, I texted Melania, "Do not listen to the noise, but from now on, I want to read the speeches. I mean it. The heck with all of them." It wasn't quite an "I told you so," but I had been suspicious about why Melania was allowed to work on her own speech for even 1 minute. You'd think someone would be paying closer attention to the woman who could be First Lady. Unlike, say, Ivanka, who probably had the top 5 people on the campaign working on her speech with focus group vetting and multiple full staff rehearsals, Melania had no one in her corner. She didn't have a hand-picked, loyal communications team backing her up. One could say that since she didn't participate in the primaries, it stands to reason that none of the campaign staff knew her well or cared that much about her. But Melania was going out on that stage as the wife of the nominee. Out of the most basic respect and consideration, someone of high caliber should have helped her, or at least read her speech, or done due diligence by running it through a plagiarism search program on the internet. Melania was treated like a second-class citizen, and her speech was an afterthought, dashed off. She replied on July 20th, "Don't worry, liberal media bashing, nothing new. It is not the first time or last time. Love you." But the media was only reporting the truth. The plagiarism was undeniable. The real story was how the Trump campaign could ever let this happen. Trump surrogates like Sean Spicer went into overdrive to defend Melania, making all kinds of excuses, even saying that the lifted paragraphs weren't all that original in the first place. The official story was that Melania had given Obama's speech to her collaborator, a Trump Organization ghostwriter named Meredith McIver, for inspiration, and somewhere along the way, those passages made it into the final draft. McIver took all the blame and offered to resign from her long-standing job at Donald's company. He refused to accept her resignation. If you're caught plagiarizing in school, you get in trouble. But no one really suffered from this incident. No firings, no public flogging. How did Melania really feel about the incident? She was not all that humiliated. Any other human would have been. But she doesn't do shame. She was suspicious that the plagiarism had been left in on purpose. Someone in Trump world didn't want Melania to shine. We talked about who that might be. Who stood to gain by making Melania look bad? Our conversations were guarded, and she kept it light, as always. But it seemed to her, and to me, that the plagiarized speech was like drawing first blood between rivals. Or was it a warning that Melania should stay in the background? The naked photos. It's believed that Melania was so mortified by what happened at the convention that she brushed her hands off and said, "That's that," about doing another damn thing for the campaign. In truth, she did take 5 giant steps back, but not because she was mortified or embarrassed. It was obvious no one had her back, so this gave her an excuse to stay in the background. She used her devastation to beg off any further duties, and no one, not Hope Hicks or Kellyanne Conway, or even Donald himself, was in any position to convince her otherwise. She was happy, she was relieved, she was back at home, back with Barron, in her bathrobe, with a smile on her face. 10 days after the convention, Melania was in the hot seat again. She couldn't avoid it, even sequestered in her penthouse. Rupert Murdoch's New York Post ran a nude photo of Melania on the cover with the leering headline, "The Ogle Office." The pictures, when were published inside the paper, had been taken in 1996, when she was 25, and had run in Max, a French men's magazine, in 1997. As awkward as it may have been for Melania to explain to Barron why Mommy was nude on the cover of a tabloid, I'm sure one part of her looked at the images and thought, "Damn, I look good." Many a woman would be publicly outraged but privately gloating. As soon as I saw the paper, I texted, "Hi, WTF. I just saw the post. Want to talk?" She wrote back immediately, not surprised. They would do anything to bash me. "No worries. Not first time. Will not be last. Have thick skin. Liberal media making big deal of nothing. One day story. Love you." But the post wasn't the liberal media. Trump and Murdoch have a bromance. It was rumored, and widely acknowledged within Trump circles, that Donald himself was responsible for his pal media mogul Rupert Murdoch's learning about the existence of the photos. Why do it? Perhaps Donald just needed to move the national conversation away from whatever incendiary tweet he'd posted that day. Or to change the conversation from Donald's indiscretions. Or he had to back up his frequent claims of her being a top model. She'd already been outed for the claim in her bio that she'd graduated from college with a degree. Or maybe he thought his campaign needed to show America exactly what he was getting into bed with on the nights they were in the same city, on the nights they were in the same room, on the nights they were in the same bed. As far as I know, Melania never forgave Rupert Murdoch. Knowing how the press operated, I spent the weekend at my in-law's home in Quag, locked in my bedroom, researching Max and those who have graced the cover to legitimize it as a real fashion publication and not just some spank mag. My kids banged on my door, asking me to come outside and join them. Instead, since Melania didn't have anyone on the campaign team she could trust, I stepped up and wrote a memo for her in case the press asked her to defend herself, not that she needed to say anything. To MT, from SWW, date July 31st, 2016. Re-Max Magazine. Facts that you can say, I have written myself. Supermodels and celebrities have graced the cover of Max Magazine. All of the most coveted photographers, such as Mario Testino, Terry Richardson, Helmut Newton, Annie Leibovitz, and Richard Avedon, photograph models in the nude. All of the most magnificent museums celebrate the beauty of the human form. Nudity is an expression of oneself. You are confident and strong, empowering. You are a kind, intelligent, and beautiful woman who is being portrayed as someone who is unqualified to become the first lady. You welcome the challenge and stand tall. You have nothing to be ashamed of, and you have nothing to hide. You are a model, and we're fortunately at the right place at the right time. Life is about embracing the unexpected moments and living every moment in the moment. When you became Mrs. T, You had to adapt to the world Mr. T lived in, and you did so in a sophisticated and elegant manner. We all go through transformations when given the opportunity to do so. You should not be scrutinized and polarized because you met and married DT. You were a model, on the go, living in the moment. He picked you. He was a real estate tycoon and celebrity. You live your life caring for your immediate family. Along with Melania's talking points, I included a 1996 Max cover with future French First Lady Carla Bruni Sarkozy without a shirt on. The memo was the first I'd write for Melania's defense against the media and the first where I gave her language to say that she had written herself. In the White House, my gross writing for her would become a daily part of my job. I sent her the memo in the early morning, and within hours, Trump advisor and speechwriter Jason Miller went on CNN's reliable sources and said, "These were photos that are 20 years old, before Mrs. Trump met Mr. Trump. They're a celebration of the human body as art. There's nothing to be embarrassed about with the pictures. She's a beautiful woman." My talking points exactly. I could help my friend, keep my privacy, and protect her. It seemed like the perfect combination, since nearly everyone I knew in fashion, entertainment, and the media hated the Trumps with a passion. I didn't hide my feelings for Melania, or that I was helping her from my friends. But I did want to retain a degree of anonymity out of respect for her. Several weeks after the post covers, there was a second one, with pictures of a naked Melania in an embrace with another nude model. A Maryland blogger named Webster Griffin Tarpley posted an article alleging that Melania's modeling agency in Europe was actually a high-end escort service. A couple of weeks after that, on August 20th, 2016, British tabloid The Daily Mail published an article online with the headline, "Naked Photo Shoots and Troubling Questions About Visas That Won't Go Away: The Very Racy Past of Donald Trump's Slovenian Wife," which echoed Tarpley's claims. She sued both with a vengeance, and they retracted. Still, Melania's nude pictures and all that escort smoke hinted at the very real possibility that perhaps she had other secrets yet to be revealed. By August 21st, she was way over it. She texted from Bedminster, "How are you? How is Z? DT and B won parent-child golf championship, so boys are happy. Lunch? The Mark? Charlie who?" Designer Rachel Roy and I have been friends for years. We worked together on many projects, and I included her in symposia and helped her on her presentations and installations during Fashion Week. We saw each other on joint family vacations, hung out, had dinners. We had a normal friendship like any two women. I was the connective tissue between Rachel and Melania, and through me, the relationship went up a notch. Rachel sometimes joined us at lunches and on group texts. On September 8, 2016, Rachel, Melania, and I had a lunch date at the Jean Georges restaurant at the Trump International Hotel and Tower. I remember Melania wore a cream Balmain jacket and looked like she was floating on air. She was happy that day, the vexing summer behind her, Barron back in school. She could relax with her two pals over a great meal. Jean-Georges Van Gerichten himself stopped by our table in the middle of the restaurant to say bonjour and give kisses all around. Every person in the restaurant seemed to watch the interaction, including a swarm of 10 Secret Service agents in black that dotted the periphery of the restaurant. We were conscious of being the center of attention, so we leaned forward with our elbows on the table, our three foreheads practically touching, and talked in giggly whispers so no one could hear. We gossiped and discussed the business Rachel and I were trying to get going, but we kept bringing it back to the obvious, saying, "Holy shit, can you believe you might be First Lady?" Melania laughed and beamed and said, "I know, right?" She was just enjoying a lighthearted moment with pals. If she was worried about the election, which was 2 months away, she gave no sign of it at all. I needed the friendly distraction, too. Work was busy, deals were pending, and my kids' health issues were flaring up. I didn't want to bring any of it up at lunch. This meal was about fun. I needed a break, if only for an hour. After we finished, we exited the restaurant, still inside the narrow entryway, and began our goodbyes. "Wait," Rachel said, "get together. We need to take a picture." The three of us scrunched together, posing for some selfies while I snapped away. We were all in a giddy mood and started to do what we called the Melania pose, fixing our hair, acting up. In that state of mind, it was all silly and hilarious. When you get Melania laughing so hard, she cries. It's impossible not to feel joy deep in your heart. And all three of us were basking in friend love. When we left, escalades were lined up all along the curb, swarming with security. It was a shocking reminder that the woman we'd just been taking duck face selfies with was under constant 24/7 protection by people with guns. Our text exchange the next day was strictly middle school. MT, so much fun, heart eyes emoji. RR, I'm still laughing about our selfies. Laughing, crying emoji. SWW, love, love, love. MT, three heart emojis. SWW, Charlie's Angels have nothing on us. Election night. The first time I voted in a presidential election was in 2016. Two reasons I hadn't voted before. One, I knew nothing about policy. If you asked me the difference between Barack Obama's and Mitt Romney's stances on immigration or to explain their economic plans, I would not know where to begin. Two, I fell exactly in the middle between Democrat and Republican. On some issues I care deeply about, I would never vote Republican. I'm conservative in other areas and can't in good conscience vote Democratic. Unable to choose, I just couldn't pull the lever. I know that people have fought and died for my right to vote, and it was wrong of me not to perform my civic duty. I was patriotic in my support of American charities and local causes, but my activism was apolitical. My humanitarian work wasn't about left versus right or red versus blue. It was about right versus wrong. But on the morning of Tuesday, November 8th, 2016, I performed my civic duty with excitement. David and I voted together. Like him, my mother, and my in-laws, I voted for Trump. I was aware that the vast majority of my fellow New Yorkers had probably voted for Hillary Clinton. New York City was a Democratic stronghold and Clinton's home base. The fashion entertainment industries in particular were actively supporting Hillary Clinton. I understood why my colleagues and city were loyal to her, and that if they knew I'd voted for her opponent, they might have some choice words for me. I pushed aside all of the Trump hate around me and voted for my friend's husband. On election night, colleagues and friends were celebrating at the Jacob K. Javits Convention Center on 11th Avenue in Manhattan, where Clinton was expected to break the figurative glass ceiling by becoming the first woman president in our nation's history. I was in Midtown at Pietro's on East 43rd Street with my husband, kids, and in-laws, celebrating my father-in-law's birthday. Our plan was to bring the kids home, change, and head out to the New York Hilton on 6th Avenue for the invite-only Trump election night party. Melania and I texted early and said we'd see each other there. After dinner, we headed back to our apartment, went into the playroom, turned on the television. I was like a nervous school kid, unable to keep still. David and the children were in and out of the room, but I didn't want to miss a moment. Donald was winning states that Hillary should have won, but his victory was not guaranteed. David came to sit next to me with a big grin. He said, if we're going to go, we should leave in about 30 minutes. I leapt up filled with excitement and started clapping, yes, let's go. Zachary and Tyra looked at me like, what's wrong with you? Alexi couldn't wait to help me pick out my outfit and get ready. You'll see, he's going to win, I said. With that, I strutted out of the room, down the hall, and into my bedroom with Alexi. I stared at my closet, not sure what to wear. Automatically, I grabbed my red Altuzaro suit, thinking, it's perfect. American-made. Good start. I love it, Mommy, Alexi said. But that's a lot of red. I wasn't sure if it was too red, but I know who would know. I called Rachel in Los Angeles. Hi, I said. I'm on my way to Trumpland. She said, shut up. You're a good friend to show support. We talked over each other, laughing. Every other word out of our mouths had four letters. Rachel agreed with Alexi that my outfit was way too loud, too obvious, and advised I should wear something neutral. I wore a cream pussy bow blouse and a black suit with white stitching. Love you, honey, I said. I'll call you from there. Don't forget to take selfies, Rachel said. David and I taxied to the Hilton at around 10 p.m. Our family friend, Stephen Mnuchin, Trump's campaign finance chair, came out to meet us and take us to a private reception. The place was packed with Trump supporters. At first, not all of them really believed he'd win. But as the night wore on, with more and more states turning red, Trump's victory seemed inevitable. The excitement level got higher and higher. At 2:30 a.m., Wisconsin went for Trump, pushing him over the line of the 270 electoral votes needed for victory. Clinton conceded at 2:35 a.m. on Wednesday morning. When news of that rolled through the crowd, the Hilton erupted. I was cheering along, jumping higher than most, even in my heels. Underneath the pulsing energy of the crowd, I was quietly, privately, proud and thrilled for Melania. I remember thinking that hers was a great American immigrant story, and certainly one of the most unique. Victory had been declared, but there was no sign of the victor. The crowd didn't seem to know what to do next. I texted Melania, "People are starting to leave. What are you doing?" She replied, "We're on the way." I shouted to David, "They're on the way." A few minutes later, the Trump family arrived at the Hilton and took the stage. I was cheering from below, videotaping their entrance and Donald's acceptance speech, while commenting on a group text with Rachel Roy and Melania. Rachel, who was watching on CNN, texted, "DT is amazing. MT is so beautiful. Speech very Donald, who we all know and love." I scoffed at her flattery. Rachel was a lifelong Democrat. "Our work is just beginning. Let's be the change we want to see in the world. Let's work for women and children," Rachel again. She'd been involved in children's causes at the United Nations and worked closely with Deepak Chopra on them. I couldn't have agreed more. Melania, with our help, could shine a light on the needs of children refugees and so much more. Unlike Rachel, though, I knew that as soon as a friend asked Melania to get involved in a business-type partnership, she would bristle. It was too close for comfort, not her style to mix the two. I'd never done it. And now Rachel was promoting her agenda and advocating for a role before Melania had even left the Hilton stage. I wrote, "Here we go, girls, we're going to laugh a lot," what I thought of as a sign-off. Rachel kept going, "This shit is crazy. You have always been this role. You have lived it. You got this. Saying a prayer for Donald's safety." Melania has always been the role of first lady? Really? 20 years ago, she had been a barely getting by model in Paris. 30 years ago, she lived in communist Slovenia. Rachel was a bit overexcited. I tried to get to the heart of the matter. "We love you. Strong support." Melania finally texted back at 4 a.m., "Love you both." The next day, Rachel asked to meet Melania and her mom for a celebration lunch in NYC or D.C. Melania's answer, "I need to see my schedule," to which Rachel replied, "Yes, Madam President, no pressure," heart emoji. I'm not sure it ever happened. Melania does so hate to be asked for anything.